Minisode. Welcome to the Minisode. This is an episode of Reading Pop Classics in between us actually reading pop classics, where we're going to discuss books that we've read recently that are not in the Reading Pop Classics reading list, and books that we are planning to read or in the middle of that are also not in the Reading Pop Classics reading list. Rebecca, what are you reading?
So I literally today...
A hell of an intro, by the way, wasn't
that
it?
That was quite an intro, yes.
Right into it.
And like all one breath.
Yeah, no preamble.
No preamble at all. So I literally, right before we sat down to do our minisode, have just finished I Who Have Never Known Men by Jacqueline Hartman.
Did they make a movie out of it?
The title is familiar to me. So this is by a Belgium...
I've never read it.
It's by a Belgian writer. The book is around 100 years old, and it's one of those things that people know about and nobody knows about. And I have heard of it before.
That's how it feels. I know that title.
You know the title. And I know of it because it is like, because it is like feminist canon.
So like,
it's a hell of a title. And I have, yeah, so it was a title I was familiar with. And then literally, I think, just last week, I was scrolling on Instagram and the New Yorker has done like a literary review of it, or like a book review of it. As we were discussing right before this podcast, I'm still waiting for my New Yorker subscription to restart, but I do get blurbs on Instagram and that has sustained me. But anyway, so there was a blurb about this book and how it's been republished. It's been translated and republished recently, and that it was feminist speculative literature, and all of those words speak to me. And so I went on ThriftBooks and ordered it immediately, actually before I even ordered our upcoming Reading Pop Classics book. And then I realized that while I was on ThriftBooks, I had not gotten my Reading Pop Classics book. But anyways, I ordered this and some other things that I will be talking about on the podcast. It's a short read. It's 164 pages. So that's right up your alley. I've spent the weekend in the past 2 days reading it.
Yeah, more books should be 164 pages.
They honestly really should. And this book slaps in 164 pages. First of all, there are no chapters. It is just a straight read through, which is really interesting because the book itself is about a little bit of monotony. But to recap it, we come upon a scene where 39 women and a young girl, probably puberty age, like preteen age, are living imprisoned in a cage with mattresses, tunics. They are given food twice a day. Lights are always on. They never go off. They are dimmed in the evening. They have no sense of time. They don't all remember how they got. They don't really know how they got there. They know something about like their lives before. They're mostly a group of women that were homemakers or would have been like working class, so not very educated. And then this young girl. And the narrator is this young woman. And then eventually they do get out of the cage by this like fluke occurrence and discover like the world outside of the cage, which we are not entirely sure whether or not it is Earth. And there's no one else. They don't come across anyone else. They come across all these other bunkers. They come across all these other bunkers where people have not been let out. All these other bunkers that have 38 to 40 people in them that have died because they weren't able to get out of the bunker when all the guards left. And it just goes from there. I don't feel like I've summed this up very well, but it just
That's
goes.
Pretty good.
Yeah, it goes from there. And so it is this incredible story of, so the girl remembers nothing from before. She has no idea where she came from. None of the women in the cage are her mother. So she is stripped of everything that we would think makes up like a life and humanity. And it makes her like an incredibly interesting narrator. The only life she has ever known is being in this cage. The women aren't allowed to touch each other. They're not allowed to touch each other. So like they've all found themselves and they've been drugged. Like their theory is that like they've been drugged for some years off and on, which is like why they don't really remember what happened and like how they ended up there. But they can't like care for her. They can't touch her. So they can't really care for her or anything either. So it's not even like she's had the experience of growing up in this like clan of women that care for her in the time that she's in the time that they're in the cage, because they're not allowed to touch each other.
Huh. Who wrote it?
Jacqueline Hartman. So she is Belgian. She fled to Casablanca with her family during World War II. So this story, this is on the back of the book. This story is informed by her background as a psychoanalyst in her youth and exile. I, Who Have Never Known Men is a haunting, heartbreaking, post-apocalyptic novel of female friendship and intimacy and the lengths people will go to maintain their humanity in the face of devastation. And it does read a little bit, it reads a little bit philosophical. It almost reads like something that you would read. It is almost written as like something you would read in a philosophy class, except that it has a narrative. And I found it to be incredibly gripping. I flew, like I said, it was only 164 pages, but I think I started it Saturday. And I haven't put a ton of time into reading it, but I flew through it. I was incredibly gripped by it. I was never at any point. So like I said, it's like there's no chapters, there's no break in the story or the narrative. And like their life and their sense of time, and like even once they're out of the cage, is like incredibly monotonous, but it doesn't feel that way when you're reading the book. The book is incredibly gripping and interesting.
I wonder if Tina Fey read that and tracked some of it onto Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt.
Oh, possibly.
Although that was pretty cool. That was a, what was it?
That was cultish.
Over cult. Yeah, that's true.
And
John Hamm, the con man who put them in there, was later on in the show. So
he does come back in the show. So there are men in this novel. When they're in the bunker initially, they are guarded. There are three guards all of the time, but they don't speak to them.
What are the other bunker stories? There's Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. There's Blast from the Past. I don't know of any other literature that I can think of that I've read that's bunker based. Silo?
Silo, yeah.
The books aren't called that, though. The books are called Wool, or the first one anyway is called Wool.
It is. It has a different name. And then the second one's called Silo or something. It's a series of three, I think, right?
I think it's a triptych or a trilogy. They're in a silo under the earth. No one really remembers. Like, anyone who was an original there is long dead. And it's just their society that
they've
just
lived that way for years. And they send one person out every so often to see if like the air outside of the silos is okay. And then that person dies, basically. They like draw straws to see who has to go out. Isn't it something like that?
It's a punishment that if you break a law, like if you break certain laws, you can be sent out to clean. And by that, they mean you go out and you clean the little like camera lens or the little box the camera is in that allows them to see. It's one camera pointing straight outside in the front of the school in one direction. And they send people out to do that. And then they send one lady out who's like our main character who survives. And then her story goes on from there.
Right. And then that's where it goes into the rest of the book. So yeah, so that's another bunker story. Yeah, those are all I can think of. But this is definitely, it's sci-fi. It's post-apocalyptic. It's essentially, we think it's post-apocalyptic. We don't know what happened. We don't know how the women ended up there. They don't know how they ended up there. They recall like a brief time of, they recall this like brief period of like chaos, and that's all they can remember. And then they're just in the monotony of being in this cage, being fed twice a day. They can talk to each other and stuff, but they can't touch each other. There's nothing to do. They don't have books.
I like it when books and movies don't explain. It's a very, I think there's other, like, when you see, like, Japanese horror movies, for example, they don't necessarily always feel the need to explain how the monster got there or how the, like, spirits or the entities got there. Like, that's not necessarily what the, like, when we watch a horror movie, like an American horror movie, we're often trying to figure out, like, how did the house get haunted? Where did the ghost come from? Where did Freddy Krueger come from? And you see, like, Japanese horror movies don't necessarily feel the need to do that. Just like, look, there's a monster. That's the story. The monster's there, and then what happens when you meet the monster? And that's what we're dealing with. We're not worried about origin. And it wasn't until, I don't know, was it like the 90s or the 2000s where Hollywood started remaking all of these Japanese horror films? Mm-hmm. Like, The Ring was really popular, so they started doing The Grudge and other ones where suddenly you could go back and kind of watch the original and be like, I don't know, I noticed it, where I was sort of like, oh, that's almost all of American fiction feels the need to explain. And I never questioned it before, but it's interesting to not have the origin laid out before you as a reason.
Yes. And you know, as you were saying that, I was thinking that's usually not what's behind post-apocalyptic novels either, where you're usually looking at like the world broke down for these reasons.
Yeah, that's what we're trying to.
Like, if we're talking, like we're talking about, we've talked about the parable of the sower. Is that the only post-apocalyptic novel we've done?
I think so. I think that's our only. Well, it's not our only sci-fi. I guess we.
It's not our only. It's not our only sci-fi, but it's our kind of our only like dystopian. Post-apocalyptic.
Yeah.
And there's reason. And there's reasons. Like, we're looking back on like how the world. Like, we're often looking back at that in those dystopian novels or in those post-apocalyptic novels of like there is often some breakdown of like kind of what was going on before and how they've gotten.
Yeah, it's a
how
cultural,
they've gotten
it's
to that
cultural
point.
Trait of Americans. Like, we're a therapy-based culture. Like, what explains me? What explains like the people around me? And we put it into our fiction and our stories as well because it's something we want to know.
Right. And this is not an American author. This is not an American author. And so, yes, there's very little explanation in here. And it is very well done. And it is very worth the 164 pages read. In fact, I will give it to you next time I see you. I think you'll enjoy it. I think you're really going to like it. And I'll give it to you when I see you next. And you'll fly through it. I know you love a short novel. So do I.
I do. More books should be that length. One of the ones that I've read recently is I read Legends of the Fall.
Oh, wow.
By Jim Hamilton. So the book is called Legends of the Fall. It's three novellas. One of the novellas within it is Legends of the Fall.
Oh, I
and
see. Okay.
All of the stories within the book are, I don't know, maybe 80 to 90 pages, 80 to 100 pages, something like that. This guy is maybe one of the most unsung American authors I've ever come across. I guess they made a really big budget movie out of one of his stories. So maybe not completely unsung, but you just don't hear about him in, I don't know, the classic literature discussion.
But legitimately, I don't think I knew that was a book. I don't think I knew it was based on a novel. That also, it came out when I was young, so I don't know if it was ever a thing I knew. Maybe I forgot.
That was in the like America Meet Brad Pitt era of movies.
Where, yeah, right. That was when we had young, hot Brad Pitt before he, I don't know, people don't like Brad Pitt now.
Seven, Legends of the Fall, and Interview with a Vampire, I think, are the three big ones that blew him up. I think he... Louise was where we like first took,
notice.
And then those were his like three starring vehicles.
Yeah.
The movie tracks with the book or with the novella for the most part. The movie makes some changes that are completely fine for the need to structure a movie around this like novella that just kind of like you described in I Who Have Not Known Men. They all just like kind of rocket through from start to finish, but highly recommend Jim Harrison. I've read two books of his novellas now. I read Legends of the Fall and The Woman Lit by Fireflies, and both of them are great and they're quick reads. Even if you only read one of the stories, you've gotten like an entire mini novel under your belt and they go quick. He's a great stylist and I don't know, he just... The minute you start reading, like the story's just moving.
Our minisode today.
Like our minisode today. Another one that I've read in between our assigned reading, so to speak, is I just want to blow this lady up. She's still writing, I think. Her name's Mary Robison. So I read one book earlier this year that I think I gave you called Tell Me, I think.
Tell Me.
It's on that fireplace mantle.
It's like Wreath One.
No, that is Kristen Lavran's daughter, which I also highly recommend. That is a historical novel set in Sweden that I heard about on the internet. And
Tell Me? Just Tell Me? I got, because you said Mary Robison, and I was like, yeah, that sounds familiar. And now I'm trying to, because yeah, I'm guessing.
Go look at that stack real quick.
I was looking at Mary Robison real quick. Yeah, I'm going to go look at my stack and see if I see Robison in there. I'll be right back. No, I don't have a Robison over there. Yeah, I'm looking her up.
Hang on, let me look up the one I gave you before I go on about the one that I read.
Robison, R-O-B-E-S-O-N?
R-O-B-I-S-O-N?
R-O-B-I-S-O. Okay, S-O-N book. Oh, there we go. I was spelling it wrong. Did you give me Why Did I Ever? Why did I ever is what you gave me.
Why did I ever? Yes. Why did I ever?
Yeah. And I read that right before I moved down to Myrtle Beach. Yeah. Why did I? Yes. I just read.
Oh, did you read that?
I see. I read Why Did I Ever? You sent me that and I did really enjoy it because it was.
It's sort of weird.
It was short. It was sort of like weird stream of consciousness.
Yeah, I would call her like a super realist. Like the way she describes everything is hyper accurate in a way that makes each and every sentence interesting. And recently I read a book of hers called Days, which is a collection of short stories. And by short stories, they're each maybe 4 pages, sometimes less.
Truly short.
Truly short. You can also rip through it. And like I said, at the sentence level, she's incredible. They're almost like Raymond Carver stories, if you've ever read some. But I, for my money, she blows Raymond Carver out of the water. I think she's terrific. And you can read it quickly. They're super fun. They're super interesting. And they're these little slice of life vignettes that she puts together. But you feel like you want to live there and hang out with the people. It also weirdly feels like people you might know. I don't know. It's like she cuts into the middle. She doesn't explain a lot either. Like you just cut into the middle of the ongoing lives of three people. You get dialogue and a little bit of what they're doing for those, like the day or two that like the story takes place over and then it moves on. But they're great.
And Why Did I Ever also, that's something that feels like it starts a little bit in the middle of a conversation.
Yes, it does. That's the one.
You've picked up somebody's, because it's written a little bit diary-esque, or like a little, like a journal almost. Or it's very conversational.
It's almost like she just picks like a couple. Yes.
It's very conversational. Yeah. And yeah, so I feel like it just picks up and she starts talking about people in the novel almost like you should know who they are, and you do eventually figure out who they are, but you don't in the beginning. Just like, and then Jimmy came into my apartment and this, you know, like he always does and this, that, and the other. And then a little while later, you realize Jimmy's a friend or, you know, whatever.
Yeah, there's no, like the narration doesn't cut back to explain Jimmy or explain what he likes or what he's about or anything like that. You just, you hang out with him. They're like hangout novels. There's like a hangout novel almost. You're just, eventually you start to like get who's who and what they mean to one another, but it doesn't do any of the extra work for you. You just get to like hang out in the situation until you piece it together. And
yes.
I find that super comfortable as a reader. I like that.
I like that too. I think it's a fun way to start a novel where we don't necessarily have to be spoon-fed everything, which maybe feels a little bit, it feels maybe like cleverer, whereas like when we're spoon-fed everything and everything's up front, there's a neat symmetry to that. But I do enjoy sometimes when I'm reading of just like, should I know who this person is? Did I read about this person earlier? I don't think so. I'm just going to keep going and I assume it'll be revealed to me. And if not, I don't know. I guess I'll figure it out when my life will continue to spin or something.
I think Why Did I Ever is also maybe a little bit autobiographical, because I think Mary Robeson, in between her fiction, I think she works on screenplays. And I think the main character of Why Did I Ever, Money, is her name.
Her name is Money. And she does this. Yes. And it's very clear that she does the screenplays for money. She doesn't take it seriously. She doesn't care about it.
No. And I think Mary Robeson,
she doesn't like it. She doesn't respect anybody that she works with.
The Paris Review did one of their long form interviews with Mary Robeson, and she talks a little bit about when she was working on screenplays and like how frequently she got fired and like just got moved to another studio over and over and over again. Like she was both very good at it, but also I think exasperating. Like she was very good at certain aspects of it, but also did not like take it super seriously or care overly, I think, about the work.
Right. And that is the character in Why Did I Ever.
I also recently finished Infinite Jest.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, I wish you told me we could have had some sort of virtual Zoom cake, because I feel like that deserved a celebration.
It was a slog, I got to tell you.
Is this the one where I was at your house and it has the appendix and you thought I had taken like a bookmark or something out and you were like, it's like laborious to read. You just got to go back and look at like the index in the back or something. And I just remember being like, yeah, I'm not trying this one. This just seems miserable.
It's both incredible and incredibly frustrating at the same time. I broke it up. Like I picked that thing up and I was like, I'm not sitting and reading this straight through. This is going to be like, I decided that I would read like 50 pages a week or something like that. Cause I also you know, I read like multiple things at once. And I was like, I'm not going to sit and plow through this. It's badly designed. I'll go ahead and say you have to keep flipping to the back for all the footnotes. They're not on the page. They're in this like section of notes and errata in the back. And
oh, that's what it was.
Yeah, it makes it super annoying to read flipping back and forth with this giant like 1,000-page book. And you have to read them because he's like a postmodernist and because he's from that sort of like Dave Eggers super meta kind of cutesy era of writing that was going on in like the 90s and 2000s. He's put like a lot of the like most meaningful parts emotionally and thematically in the tiny print in the back, and also major plot points in as much as there is a plot. So you can't skip them. You can't go back and read it later. You need to read it while you're reading the thing. I'm very glad I read it. I really enjoyed it. I think about it a lot. I also, at the same time, understand, or no, maybe my recommendation would be, I think you know if you like things like this. Like, it's not a book that you should ever pick up.
I know that that's not something I want to read. Once I saw that, when I saw that book on your kitchen counter and I saw what a tome it was, and then you told me about having like about the notes, and it was just like, this is something I would read for school because I had to, and this is not something I would read on my own. And I feel like that is saying something, because there is a lot, because I think at the beginning of this podcast, I said that I was scrolling online, saw that the New Yorker had done a book review on something that was feminist speculative literature. And I was like, well, let me go order that.
Yes.
So I read things that I maybe would have been forced to read in school when I was younger and wouldn't have picked up on my own now. And I just feel like Infinite Jest is not on my list. So I'm very proud and impressed, because when I took a look at that book and all the work that went into it, I was very proud of you for taking that on. And I'm very proud of you for finishing.
It's a little bit like, you know, if you ever meet people who do those like 40,000 piece puzzles.
Yes.
Like enormous, enormous puzzles. You know if you like doing that. That's not something you pick up casually. Like, it's a project. And it's something that you're doing because it's a little bit of work that you enjoy. That's how I would describe Infinite Jest.
So you'll be surprised and impressed to learn that I actually have been reading multiple books at a time the past few weeks. So I, Who Have Never Known Men, is what I just finished. And like I said, I literally finished it about 15 minutes before I sat down for us to do the mini. And the only thing I have left is there is an afterword that I am reading. And I have a couple pages left in the afterword, which has been worth reading, because the book is very, like, it's a lot to digest, even for just to be a short book. So the afterword has been nice. But I have been reading multiple things. So one is, so as we were talking about before we started our mini-sode, and as our listeners probably do not know, among the many things that I do, One of my careers is a yoga teacher. And so recently I co-led a yoga retreat with members of a studio where I teach here, where I live. And we picked a book to read for the retreat to have as a basis of discussion. And it's a book on meditation, and it is called Wherever You Go, There You Are. And it is by Jon Kabat-Zinn. And it was something I had to read for one of my yoga teacher trainings years and years ago. And I have never read it all the way through. I've picked through like different parts of it. I've been assigned different parts of it. I've read different parts of it on my own, but it is a very straightforward meditation book. So if it's something that you are looking to get into, it does go into very straightforward, like mindfulness meditation, which is very secular. And Jon Kabat-Zinn is a PhD. But so we did discuss it on the retreat. It is, so something that some of my retreaters pointed out while we were discussing the book, he does use a lot of words for the entire point of the book to sort of be wherever you go, there you are.
It's interesting. That's a terrible title.
But
You've
he is a...
Maybe one of the best titles I've ever heard, and one of the worst titles.
And one of the worst titles you've ever heard. Wherever you go, there you are. But so I will point out, so something that we discussed on the retreat was like, well, he's a PhD. This is how educators write.
Yeah,
this is how people that are PhD. Yes, like you're expected to write your 40-page thesis
on people.
And so it is. But he does. It is a very straightforward way, I think, to get into meditation. You don't necessarily have to read the entire book. It's nonfiction, obviously. You don't have to read the entire thing. you could skip around in it and I think get just as much out of it. But it is a very good book on straightforward mindfulness that I do think is good for beginners. But yes, that was a takeaway that some people pointed out. It was like, you know, I don't know. I feel like he just spent a lot of, words to say some very simple things. And it was like, well, I mean, the man is a PhD. Yes. Like this is what you spend years and years doing this kind of writing. So that's something that I've read recently. I would recommend it if you were looking to get into meditation or you're interested in meditation. But the other book that I am in the middle of is The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test by Tom Wolfe.
Are you enjoying it?
So yes, but I had found it easy to put down and pick back up.
It meanders. That's also a weird. I describe Mary Robeson's books as like hangout books. Those are a little tighter. But I would also describe the Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test as a hangout book.
And that is a great way to say it because we are just stepping into and hanging out with these weird hippies, which appeals to me very much for which appeals to me very much as somebody who's a weird hippie who has experimented with psychedelics. So I'm very interested in the subject matter. It is understandable to me. I think he's done an excellent job writing it. I think he's done a really amazing job. I think it's like a very good, like journalistic, like a bit of a journalistic.
Yeah,
endeavor.
Tom Wolfe, the new journalism, him and there were a handful of them back then.
It's a journalistic effort. And I do really appreciate when journalists write. I do appreciate when journalists write a book about something. I find those interesting to read. I like that. I like that sort of like it's straightforward. It's in detail. And I think he's really captured the spirit of the thing. But to your point, yes, it's a hangout book. So I can read it for a little bit. And it's not monotonous because it's like interesting and weird. But yes, like it is kind of, it's a hangout book. Yeah, like you can go in and spend some time with them. And we're doing acid with the Hell's Angels. Like we're doing acid at a Beatles show. And that's a lot of fun. They're showing up at conferences and events that like Ken Kesey's been asked to speak at. And then he just shows up with a bunch of weird hippies.
Right? I read it in high school.
The Merry Pranksters.
Decades since I've read it, but I remember enjoying it.
It is because like we've discussed before that I don't know why I am a one book at a time person. I couldn't put my finger on why that is, but this has been an easy one to have going in the background while I read other stuff.
I can't say that there's a lot of benefit to being a multiple book at a time person. I often find myself regretting my decisions.
The benefit of it for me now is partly because we do the podcast. And so I'm reading something for that. It doesn't feel like a homework assignment. I often enjoy the things we're reading. And if I don't enjoy the things we're reading, then that gives me things to say on the podcast. So it's like still interesting and fun to me. But I am trying to get into it a little bit more because we're doing reading for our podcast, I have found that like my to be read pile lingers more than it might were we not doing the podcast. So I am trying to make it like a huge habit, but I am trying to get a little bit better about flipping between things so that I get more read essentially.
I think it's an underlying anxiety about the to-be-read pile perhaps, because I have a pile up at the moment that's not going great and someone's going to have to get sacrificed. But I'm currently reading The Heart is a Lonely Hunter by Carson McCullers.
Oh, wow.
Mason and Dixon by Thomas Pynchon. Invisible Monsters by Chuck Palahniuk. And
that's too many things. You're going to keep going? You have more things to say that you're reading right in this moment?
Those are. And then I finished Remarkably Bright Creatures, which we're doing on our next full-length episode. You know what? The Invisible Monsters. You know what's interesting about reading? I know you've read a handful of Chuck Palahniuk's books.
I have.
And I picked this one up because we did Fight Club on the podcast. And I got a little like nostalgic for that like voice. Mm-hmm. That style that he has, the very, very conversational, like friend in a bar kind of way that he writes.
Yeah.
He does well enough, I think, to turn into a style, right? Like the repetitive little catchy phrases that he uses over and over again. I'll say three things about it. One, you know what? He puts a Tyler Durden in every single novel I'm remembering now. Like Tyler Durden is Tyler Durden in Fight Club, but there's a Tyler Durden in every one of his books. Like there's an agent of chaos that our narrator. Like, did you read Invisible Monsters?
I think I'm trying to remember if
Let me tell you something. People talk about how cynical and dark and like maybe nihilistic Fight Club is. That is a cheerful little story compared to Invisible Monsters.
I'm looking it up now because I have to.
It's about the supermodel whose face gets shot off. And then she meets Brandy Alexander, the trans woman who is the Tyler Durden of this novel. That's the other
thing.
You
know what's weird is that I'm almost 99% sure that I have read this book and I don't remember it. I'm remembering you saying it. The name Brandy Alexander is very forefront in my mind.
The same thing I was going to say is how, I don't know what, I mean, this was the first one he wrote, but they deemed it a little bit too dark. So they published Fight Club first. Good choice, I would say, because this is, but he's a little bit ahead of his time. Like the main characters are a trans woman. There is lots of gay representation in it. All of them are characters in a book too. They're not like stand-ins or token characters that are just in there as side people. Like they are the driving characters within the story.
Right, like that's who the story is actually about.
Yes, and it's about a supermodel who's, we don't really know why, but her face gets, she's in a terrible accident. She loses almost the entire bottom half of her face below her top jaw. It's described maybe a little bit too often. And when she's in the hospital recovering, she meets Brandy Alexander, this incredibly beautiful, incredibly put together and self-possessed woman, a trans woman, who, and then they go off into a very Chuck Palahniuk style plot where they're just roaming around doing things that allow for him to write these very weird, detailed mise-en-scenes like over and over again, right? Like they go around pretending that they're like American aristocracy and they're viewing the incredibly expensive homes that the rich have for sale and pretending that they're buyers and then stealing the drugs out of the cabinets while there's three of them and one of them distracts the realtor and the other two kind of drugstore cowboy the owner's medicine cabinets and whatever. Third thing I'll say about it is, you know, I forgot how tedious that like really cool stylistic thing of him repeating stuff over and over again gets.
Yes, because Fight Club is a short book and I don't
Fight
think
Club
Invisible
is
Monsters is a short
Fight
book.
Club is short. Yes, because I am in the third act of this book and it should be over. Fight Club rockets along and then like before you can really grow weary of it, like we come to the conclusion and I, based on the popularity of that, all of his other books are like a sort of classic 300 to 330 pages.
Mm-hmm.
And that's approximately 70 to 80 pages more than he needs is my take on Chuck.
Yeah, because you only need to repeat stuff so much.
Yeah, it's cool for a little while. And then like around the halfway mark, I'm like, no, I know, man. Could something happen? Could we like move this along?
Like it drags.
Yeah, Fight Club is the like one everyone talks about for a reason. Like it's tight. It is a tight, short.
It is tight.
That, like, mm-hmm. Yeah, you get through quickly and it was interesting.
It's tight and it packs a lot in.
And I'm not enjoying this, but I wish I was done reading it. Like I wish all the things that I've read so far were being summed up in about 20 more pages and I'd be finished. I also
that is not quite the case.
No, speaking of things that are too long, I read The Odyssey. It drags at the end. I'm going to say that. I know it's too late for Homer to go back and change it. I know it's too late for him to accept this criticism, but the part where Odysseus comes home and gets to the suitors and they're having the big long dinner and he's pretending to be the homeless guy and the suitors are giving him a hard time and the whole thing, it drags. It's too long. And I think we should be harsher on classics. I think we should be way harder on classics. We just accept them as classics and we don't question a lot of things about them.
That's true. We really don't. We think that like these are classics and they're these great books that we revere. And so then it seems like they've been around so long that we have forced like that. It feels like you can't be critical. Like you can't have any critique of them. And it's like, I think what we know is people who.
Well, like, yeah. Who are you to say that Moby Dick has flaws? Like Moby Dick is the great American classic.
It's just like, because I've read some other stuff and like, I'm not saying. Because we can think that something is good and still critique it. You and I do that with books on our podcast all of the time. I listen to a podcast about the Gilmore Girls and like the guy who, the Gilmore guys. And like one of them loves the Gilmore Girls and he still finds a lot to critique about it, like in the podcast. Or like I said, you and I do that with books where it's like, we think this is a good book. We'll recommend it at the end, but like we critique it. And I think that's part of a close reading of something.
Yeah, I think so. And I think it's fun to do. It's something that I enjoy. Like you
we're
and I
reading
both
these books to, I mean, we're reading these books to study them and to see, I think, what it is that make them classics.
You and I both listen to Just King Things.
And we both listen to Just King Things. And yeah.
They're doing a very like academic appraisal of Stephen King's work and like themes and recurrences and underlying subtext and stuff like that, which I find fun. Like it's enjoyable for me to do that, but particularly with Stephen King, I think there's probably a lot of people who are just sort of like, man, can't you just enjoy this start to finish as just a fun read?
And certainly you can. You don't have to listen to a podcast about it. Did you see that he is like in the news today? I'm not sure that we're going to have very many more Stephen King books. I think he's going to stop writing. I guess he's having some health issues and he wants to stop writing.
The hell he is. Stephen King was hit by a van, left for dead on the side of the road, laid there for something like 3 days before like a hitchhiker found him, and it delayed his next book by 15 minutes. That man.
Was that a hit and run? I was talking about that with somebody today.
Yeah.
But I have read he wrote an article about it at the time that was like in the New Yorker, I think, right?
He can't stop writing about that. He can't stop writing.
And then he's written it. And then it was in the Dark Tower series. And I want to say it was in something else. And so now I have read his like fictitious versions of it so many times that I don't actually remember what happened to him.
No, it's a hit and run. The guy got out and I think saw him and talked to him and then left. He was arrested later.
Right. Because that's what I was thinking. Because I was thinking it was like, one of my yoga students brought me, knew I liked Stephen King and was a big fan of The New Yorker. And she printed out the article that he wrote for The New Yorker. It was like a back issue or something. She had like access to go like back into all the archives. And she printed out the article that he wrote about the accident that I came out shortly after it happened. She gave it to me. And I remember him saying that, like, he had a conversation with the guy.
Yeah, the guy got out and talked to him. It happened very much like a Stephen King novel. I mean,
but
I don't
then
know
he left him there and they didn't find him?
I don't know if that's because Stephen King describes it that way. And Stephen King can only describe things as Stephen King novels. And he's the most, like, prolific. He's a one in a million. Like, we're not going to get another one of him.
But it's funny, the conversation I had was one of my, I had a conversation with somebody at work today that was like, oh, did you see this? And I was like, well, that's, but we talked about it. It was like, oh, I guess he's like having some health issues or whatever is like why he said he might not be writing. And then it was like, I don't know that he is capable of not just like producing stories.
I don't think he is.
I've just assumed we were going to get one from his deathbed and that his son Owen will finish it if he doesn't quite get to the ending.
We're going to find two in his coffin that he like put there and forgot about. And I just assume he already owns his own coffin.
Stephen King, he might.
That's just my headcanon for Stephen King. But no, I'll believe it when I see it, that his body of, he just can't quit. He can't stop writing. It's an addiction. He has an addictive personality. He's an addictive person. And without anything else to go on, the writing is just forefront of like the thing I think he mainlines on.
I think you're, and I hope that's true. He's like Dolly Parton. I just want him to be doing things as long as he's alive. He's a delightful person who puts interesting things into the world. And like, I want that as long as he's willing to give it to us. And they both just seem like people who are willing to give us these things for the duration of their lives.
I always think it's funny in the books when like they mention like, you know, his wife, Tabitha King, who was also a writer. And like, I can't imagine what a drag it is to be a writer who like, oh, like of all the writers I could be married to, it's the guy he puts out like 3 books a year some years.
Right. That must be an infuriating thing. She's written a lot of books though.
Has she? I've never ever seen one in a store.
I've never seen one in a store either. I was just thinking about this today, but I want to say that I was like looking her up one day when I realized that she was also a writer and was like, how did I not know she was a writer? I thought she had a lot. I'm looking now. I thought she had kind of a lot.
It's always in his books where it's just like, and she's also a writer. And I know that, but I've never seen one of her. If I go into any airport, there's like Stephen King books and like a wire rack spinning around. They're all over the shelves.
Yeah.
There's Joe Hill books. His son's books are right out there. I've never in real life seen a Tabitha King book.
Looks like she has 16.
I've never seen a physical.
She's 16
and
books.
16 is a hell, wait, what, a hell of a lot of books.
Wait, who's the son? Who's the son that you said that's writing?
His son writes under the name Joe Hill.
Oh, that's right. Joe Hill.
16 books is a hell of a lot of books,
unless you're married to Stephen King, who has, I don't know, how many books has this man written? I'm going to look it up.
I'm going to say, if you're looking it up, all right, I'm going to take a guess. I'm going to say he's written 93 books.
65. And over 200 really? Shorts. 65, including 7 under Richard Bachman. Yeah, okay. He has 65 novels or novellas.
Well, I overshot it.
But... okay, 65 novels and novellas, including 7 under the pen name Richard Bachman, and 5 fiction books. So that's 70 books total. He has written over 200 short stories, most of which have been compiled in book collections.
Oh, okay. 93 might still be overshooting it, but it seems like 65, based on what you just read, is also undershooting it. You did just remind me, though, I don't have it in my... So I think Carson McCullers is going to have to go. Not, I'm enjoying it, but I just think someone's got to take a back seat.
You're not going to finish it? Or are you just like, I finish it right now?
Shit, I think I need to get Invisible Monsters out of my life.
It's not even like a hate read or anything, but it's just, I just have to finish this. I cannot be reading this book anymore. I want to be done with it, and I want it to not be in my...
I wanted to read the book I'm reading. I wanted to read him as a treat because Fight Club had stirred up my appetite for this particular style of writing. And instead of ordering a slice of cake, I have ordered a whole cake.
Yeah.
And I wish I wasn't eating an entire cake.
Yes.
But I ordered it and I don't waste food. So I the last 60 pages of this damn thing. And then I think what am I going to do? Maybe I'll finish the Thomas Pynchon book because I'm liking that one, and then I'll come back to Carson McCullers. But you just reminded me that I have Firestarter by Stephen King sitting over here because it's the first Stephen King book I ever read.
It's the first Stephen King book I ever read, too. And it is to this day still one of my favorites.
I've been saving the Just King Things episode of Firestarter because I want to reread it first, because I read it, whatever, like eighth grade or ninth grade.
I've read it twice. I read it when I was like 22 or something, and then I read it again. Maybe a couple years ago.
But I want to read it before I listen to that episode. So maybe I'll scrap all of these things and put them on the back burner and maybe I'll start another.
You'll fly through. You'd fly through Firestarter though. I have a King book on the docket. My to be read pile. I got to look it up. It was a gift. And it's one of the thicker ones. It's one of the big ones. Oh, Needful Things.
Oh, I haven't read that one. I'll tell you which one sucks. Fairy Tale.
Is that... Fairy Tale? Is that new?
Yeah, like in the last 2 years or 3 years or something. It's a Stephen King book, so like when I say it sucks, it's a white wine, right? It's a champagne problem. Like it's still a Stephen King book. It still moves.
I was just going to say, yeah, I've never read anything by Stephen King that I put down. It was just like that sucked and was absolute drivel. But I've read a couple things that were just like, well, this was definitely not like this.
He gets out of pocket sometimes.
This wasn't, this one wasn't that good. But you know what? It's like pizza. You can get one of those like Stouffer's French bread pizzas and heat it up on like a Friday night because you didn't feel like cooking and it was on sale and it was still pizza.
Yeah, that's the Fairy Tale feels exactly like he found 3 unfinished novels in a drawer and was like, I don't know, fuck it, I'll put them together like this. Now it's called Fairy Tale. It's 3. He just mashed 3 books into 1 book. And was like, I don't know, it's the story of a young guy and his dad and his mom gets killed by a car. And then it's the story of a young guy who meets an old man that's interesting. And then it's also a story of a young guy who goes into a fairy tale kingdom and deals with that. And he just stapled the end and beginning pages of them together and turned them into his editor.
Who was just like, well, it's got Steven's name on it, so it's probably good.
Yeah,
probably
yeah.
So didn't even read it.
Let me slap a cover on this and go ahead and just take out the ads for New York Times bestseller.
Yeah.
Guaranteed.
I have needful things on the docket for Stephen King. Like I said, both of these were gifts. And then The Talisman, which is with Stephen King and Peter Straub. I don't know who Peter Straub is.
Peter Straub was a contemporary of his, and I know less about his work, but I know that they were admirers of one another. I think they wrote books like that, which do books like that still exist?
What do you mean books? I need what be more specific about books like that.
I don't know. The big fiction books that come out, like Tom Clancy and John Grisham.
The Talisman is
King Solver. Well, yeah. This would
The Talisman is
Straub.
Old. This was a, The Talisman is as old
Straub
as me.
Straub might even be dead.
It came out in 1984, which is also the same year I premiered. Oh, it has connections to King's The Dark Tower series.
Well, everything
has connections to King's The Dark Tower series. Did you finally finish that, speaking of Stephen King?
I did. I'm listening to the Just King Things episodes. I'm listening to the Dark Tower books now. I know that they do them in publication order. I am listening to the ones on the Dark Tower series.
Oh, maybe I'll skip. Yeah, I've been skipping around on Just King Things. I'm not listening to it in the order that they came out. I'm listening to it in order of what I feel like listening to while I drive around all day. Oh, maybe I need to start the Dark Tower.
I love the first three of the Dark Tower. I hate the fourth one of the Dark Tower.
Wizards and Glass, that's where we lost you. That's where you gave up in terms of the reading there. I think you've come back, but...
No, I finished it eventually, but I didn't care for that one. And then the final three that he wrote, 1, 2, 3 in a row, are good. The first three, I think, are a little bit special. I like those where they skip around. He's figuring it out still. The stories vary a little bit. And to be fair, that actually lasts up until the fourth one. Wizard and Glass also varies in story style and structure. I just didn't particularly like that one. But then the final three, he's just writing the final three in a row of finishing his Dark Tower series. And they feel like one book broken up into three books, whereas the first four feel like four individual books to me.
Oh, and they came out all at different times. Oh, here's The Gunslinger. Okay.
So it's the Gunslinger came out in 1975.
It's The Gunslinger and then The Drawing of the Three, 1982. And I just know that because I'm looking. I was just getting it queued up. So when I get in the car tomorrow, I'll spend my day listening to The Gunslinger while I drive around for work tomorrow.
The Gunslinger was published like Charles Dickens style, like piecemeal in a science fiction and fantasy magazine or something like that. And it wasn't put together into a novel until later. Not a lot later, but people liked it and started asking for it. And so they put it out as a book. You know what? I'd have to look it up. I think The Drawing of the Three might have come out before The Gunslinger was published together as a novel.
What?
Anyway.
Oh, the Drawing of the Three came out before The Gunslinger was published altogether.
As a novel. It was written piecemeal.
I see what you're saying.
In four to six issues of a monthly magazine, I think,
Oh, okay. So then before they actually put it into a book that was sold on the shelves, The Drawing of the Three was like the follow-up.
I think that's correct. And so, I don't know if you were and this was like pre-internet, like back then just a new Stephen King book came out and you picked it up and you're sort of like, the hell is this?
Right. Because there is a lot of callbacks to the first one.
Yeah, yeah. Should I know some stuff? Should I have read something before I got here?
Wizards and Glass is the weird standout one because it starts with like our main three or main four characters if you count the possum. Oi, wasn't that a possum?
He was a Billy Bumbler, first of all.
Okay, I've always pictured him as possum-like.
I was a grown man who had maybe one of my most emotional moments reading a book when that Billy Bumbler has his, I won't, if people are reading it,
I won't
spoil the Dark Tower for you, but the emotional climax of Oi's story caught me way off guard.
Well, I think I cried on the subway.
Far, far more upset than I usually get reading or watching anything.
I think one of my New York,
counts. Yeah, he is one of the main characters.
He does count. He is one of the main characters, and I actually think that one of my very few New York public cries, which you're not a New Yorker if you haven't cried in public in front of people walking down the street or on the subway. But I do want to say it was literary, that I was like on the subway reading about Oi and crying and being like, people think I'm crying over a boyfriend or something, but I'm just deep into the Dark Tower. That was a very single summer for me. I think I read the entire Dark Tower series in that summer.
Oh, yeah. You and I grew up in an era where we could buy all of them at once. And by the time you and I discovered them, we could just buy the whole series and have it waiting on the shelf and just go from one to the next. But it came out.
Other people had to wait for years to get all the way through them, which...
Something like 20-something years or something like that before
it finished. It is quite the span. I had forgotten that, actually, because when I was scrolling through Just King Things... which, as you have said, they do their podcasts in order, in the order that the books were published. So I was having this moment of like, why aren't they all here together? Why am I just seeing like random titles? And it was like, oh, right, because that's how they were. That's
Those
how
guys
they were
are
put out.
They're doing the reprints.
They're even doing the reprints?
Like when Stephen King released another version of The Stand that had like the missing 150 pages, they're redoing The Stand for an episode.
Oh, they're redoing the whole Stand. That's the version I read was the long one.
Like anytime he's re-released something, they're doing the re-releases, which is wild. All right. I think that's good for this minisode. What do you think?
I think so, but I do want to tell people what I'm reading next. I have some upcomings. You have some upcomings. My upcoming, I'm waiting for it from Thrift Books, is All Fours by Miranda July, because that was...
I'm also reading that. I'm sorry, I left that out of my... That's the one I'm reading in my phone. And that's my phone book that I'm reading, that I read at night.
That's your before bed phone book.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm excited to read it. I've heard a lot about it. It's been on my list for a little while, so I just got that from Thrift Books.
It's a fun, weird little book so far. I'm like maybe a quarter of the way through it.
So yeah, I'm waiting for that to arrive from Thrift Books. And this is very unlike me. I do not usually read stuff like this, but I am going to be reading The Let Them Theory by Mel Robbins. Mostly because she has been on a lot of podcasts that I listen to. And so I'm interested to read her book. She's a good orator. Like, she's a good speaker. She's interesting on the podcast. And so I'm interested to see. And I've just been hearing a lot about the book, so I wanted to pick it up and give it a try. But I don't read a lot of nonfiction, and I guess this is technically a self-help book, and that is not something I really have any experience in reading. It'll be interesting to maybe we'll talk about it on our next minisode, and I can tell you guys about my first self-help book.
Yeah, you got to keep track of the books we talk about in here so you can talk about when you finish them. And I did my Tubi reads are all happening at the same time.
Yeah. There are other books in my to-be-read pile, for sure. I really want to get to The Reef that you gave me. And the other thing that's in my to-be-read pile is...
Kristen Lovren's Daughter series. I think you're going to like it as much as you enjoy the Neapolitan series.
Oh, not saying something.
It's not like that. It's just someone mentioned it in like one of the literary corners of the internet that I hang out in. Someone mentioned it in a post, and a follow-up was just sort of like, no one talks about this book, and it's incredible. It's been in print in Sweden for something like 60 years, whatever it is. It's well known there. Like it's one of their country's literary classics. It's not the kind of thing I would ever read. It's not I don't read a lot of historical fiction.
I do like stuff like that. I do like historical fiction. So I forgot you told me it was historical fiction.
So weirdly compelling.
Oh, and the other book that is in my to-be-read pile is Kindred by Octavia Butler, which is one of her classics. And it just, the pile on the fireplace mantle is a mix of a to-be-read and an I have read, but I am keeping. You know how like there's books that you read them and it's just like, well, now I have to own this forever. And then there's books that you read, they're like, I'll just pass this one along and let someone else read it, or that you did really like it. And it's like, I kind of want to keep this, but like, also I want to give this to somebody.
Yeah.
Anyway, so the fireplace mantle pile is a little bit of a, it's a bit of a mix of like, I've read this and it was very literary and amazing and I want to keep it. And then also some things that like are to be read. And I need to move those TBRs into the pile that is actually next to my reading chair. Yeah. I just reduced the pile today because I decided I'm going to give James to one of my patients.
Okay.
James by Percival Everett. I put that, I decided I was going to keep it, but then I was like, you know what? I want to pass this along and make sure someone else reads it. And he seemed interested when we were talking about it. So I'm going to give it to him tomorrow when I see him.
The popularity around that book is still, it's not baffling to me because it's a bad book. I really, really enjoyed it. It's just that Percival Everett's written like something like 15 books. And they're all like, James is like all of his other books. It's not like, he's not like he finally cracked the code.
Right.
It's very similar to his other works.
Do you think it's because it's based on such an American classic that it's like a book that like, because even if people haven't read Mark, if you have not read Huckleberry Finn by Mark Twain, like, you know about it.
I think it's that combined with the popularity of the film American Fiction, which came out maybe a year or two before it, which is based on his book Erasure. I think the popularity of that movie and the fact that the marketing for this book worked so well, where it's just like Percival Everett is the guy who wrote Erasure, the guy who wrote the book that American Fiction is based on, has this like wild take on Huckleberry Finn. I think like just created a moment where this one could really shine because the publishers put a lot of money behind it, because his book suddenly became the kind of thing you can sell for a film. That's, like I said, I like the book. I just think that it's, go pick
no,
up any
it's true.
Percival
and I
Everett
do think
book.
It's,
if you liked James, go pick up any Percival Everett book. They're good.
And I do think it is sometimes worth talking about how, I do think it is sometimes worth talking about how the publishing industry works, very independent of a book itself.
Yes.
Or an author, like, or an author itself. Like it is not to take away from like, this was a book, you and I both love that book. So yes, like it should not take away from whether or not the book is good or what you think about the author. But yes, the publishing industry works to sell books. And as we know, people aren't necessarily buying and reading books the way they used to.
No, I think
because we have
so
many other forms of entertainment. So it's like, you know, the publishing industry is trying to do what it can to like get people interested in books and buying books.
I think it happened like the way the story unfolds for the guy in American Fiction, who is essentially Percival Everett writing these, like, just steadily putting out these books on his own time, books that he likes that are, there's two of them in a Barnes and Noble on a bottom shelf somewhere. And then in that movie, the character writes a very incendiary book as sort of as a fuck you to the publishing industry. And it becomes a huge hit, but, and I don't think that's what he was doing with James, but that arc is kind of what actually happened with James.
Yeah.
Have you seen American Fiction?
No.
Oh, you should check it out.
To my list.
What a great movie.
Oh,
so pleased with it. Yeah.
I'll write it down. I've been trying to watch more movies. I feel like streaming has ruined my, sometimes I think streaming has ruined my attention span for movies. I watch far less movies than I used to. And I, or maybe it's just because there's like a plethora of them. It's just like very, like just less comes out in theaters. And it's like now movies seem to be like scattered across streaming devices. Whereas it used to be like movies were in theaters and you either got to see it in the theater or you rented it when it came out or it finally came to streaming. I don't know. It's like all the choice has diminished how much I watch or somehow.
I watch fewer of them in my house. There's several reasons for that though. Like just,
you have a four-year-old in your house.
Yeah, yeah, that's a huge part of it, I guess there's one. Not several, but I go to the movies a lot. Like because you can't use your phone and just, you kind of have to focus on it. But I watch fewer of them in the actual house. Like by the time the kid goes to bed and it's the evening and my wife and I sit down to watch something, it's like, let's pick something.
I do think sometimes it's that too, that it is like, yeah, I want to sit down and watch TV for an hour before I go to bed. So I'm not, and movies are all, remember when movies used to be 90 minutes?
Girl, it's
or 80 minutes. And now I feel like most movies that come out are at the minimum 2 hours or they're 2.5 or 3 hours. And I don't know. I could sit down and watch 4 episodes of a 45-minute show and feel differently about it. But like to sit down and watch a 3-hour movie feels like a real slog.
Yeah, it's tough.
Yeah, it's a lot.
So, all right.
Well, I think that sums up our minisode.
Yeah, that's it for us. We will be back in approximately a week, give or take. I don't think anybody listening to this thinks we're on any kind of schedule, so I think it's probably fine. But approximately a week, we will be back with a full-length episode on Remarkably Bright Creatures by Shelby Van Pelt. So thank you for listening. As always, you can talk to us at readingpopclassics@gmail.com or at readingpopclassics on Instagram. And
that's it. And once more, you've taken my thanks for listening line.
Oh, shit, right. That's
yours. No, he did that. I'm going to say it again because now I don't have a last line. All right. And we'll close with, and thanks for listening.